Welcome back to Screen Crush Rewind. I am your host, Ryan Airy, and we're doing something different today. We're not talking Marvel. We're not talking Star Wars. We're talking Steven Spielberg. We are going to bring on a panel of guests, of experts, to talk about the best and worst of Spielberg. Let me explain what this means. It doesn't necessarily mean we're talking about his best movie, his worst movie. We might talk about best scene, worst scene. We might talk about different types of characters. I don't fully know what everybody's going to talk about, so I'm really excited to hear from them. And let us know in the comments, and especially Super Chats if you can. Super Chats are encouraged but not required. But let us know your best and worst Spielberg moments, whatever, favorite films, and then we'll get to the comments in a little bit toward the end of the video, and we'll have our guests address those. And I'm really excited to have these guys on today. These are two people who have been on multiple times, but I don't get to see them nearly enough. First up, you know him as the editor-in-chief of ScreenCrush.com. He is also the author of one of my all-time favorite film books, Opposable Thumbs, How Siskel and Ebert Changed Movies Forever. We have Mr. Matt Singer. What's going on, Matt?
What's up? How's it going?
Good, good. I guess I should also note that if people are interested in yelling at you, they can also look at your Steven Spielberg Every Movie directed by. Your ranking is up on screencrush.com right now, and we'll have that link live below in just a little bit. I love your rankings. You always update them with every. Do you want to spoil and tell us if Disclosure Day makes the top third?
I'm not good at math, so asking me to if it makes the top third, that's tricky. I don't think it does, though, no. That doesn't mean that it's a bad movie, though. I mean, we're talking about Steven Spielberg here.
Right.
I mean, the worst movie in his filmography rates with the best movies of a lot of directors. So it's
no give shame. Us a tease. What is the worst movie in his filmography, according to you?
Well, they're going to have to click and find out.
Right? Oh, I mean, there you go. Yeah. Click that link below.
Then they can give you a super chat and yell at me about it or something.
There you go. Yeah, you guys go look over at that and then come back and let Matt know why he's wrong. And coming on, he runs my favorite film YouTube channel. I think I can say that safely. You know him as Mr. Patrick H. Willems.
Hello, Pat. Wow, Ryan, what a nice introduction. Thank you.
I don't watch a lot of, like, I watch a lot of YouTube, but I tend not to watch in our field because when I do that, I either watch something that's so good, like heavy spoilers, that I feel bad about myself, or I feel like I'm at work. But when I watch your videos, you always bring in things I've just never thought of before. You did a great one recently about the director music video to film pipeline that's, dried up over the years, or needle drops, and just always great stuff. I love your channel.
Thank you so much. Also, great timing because I am literally uploading new videos right now, and I'm in, it's Spielberg season, and so I am doing the upcoming one, and then the following one are both Spielberg related videos. So I've been thinking about the guy a lot.
Yeah, and it really is incredible. You look at other directors whose careers have spanned the same era. A lot of them, faded away over time. Some of them, like Scorsese, just got better with age. But the variety and the impact this guy's had on culture, in thinking about this, it was hard for me to even think of a worst of anything. I know he's got some things that people thought were misfires, and maybe I took low-hanging fruit with my picks. But let's start with Matt. Matt, let's do, what's your best kind of Spielberg take right now?
Well, I like you said, I think I shared the sentiment privately. Hold on. There's a large construction site active right over here. Let's close this.
I actually couldn't hear it, which is
good. Oh, good. That's good.
Yeah.
Microphone is working. Yeah. Okay.
Ryan, check your headphones.
Yes. All right. Well, hopefully it's less noisy.
It's fine now.
Okay, good. So we were talking beforehand, Ryan, about, worst Spielberg is tough. I mean, yes, he hasn't made 100% winners every time. There's a couple that are, misfires. Your 1941s, your Always's, okay.
Yeah.
Your Lost Worlds, Jurassic Parks, they're not all A-pluses, but I mean, they're kind of obvious also. So like, what do you do? And I thought instead of like a value judgment about the movies, I thought it'd be fun to talk about like one of the pervasive themes in his movies and maybe my favorites and I guess least favorite, but maybe not least favorite. It's more just I like talking about how bad they are at the thing that I'm going to be discussing, which is being a dad. Best Spielberg dads. Dads and dadhood, obviously, in a very important theme in Spielberg's movies. Even before he made The Fablemans, it was very obvious that dads, the absence of dads, was a pervasive theme in his own life that he then really kind of transmuted into his movies. And, you know, so many of his movies are about this subject, even when they don't seem obvious about it, it tends to creep in. And, you know, and you can think of almost any of his movies and you can find something interesting in it about parenthood in general, but often about fathers. And so
he has an absent father and the absent father drives the plot. He's just off screen.
That's right. And I mean, just last weekend, I have two daughters and for the first time I showed them an Indiana Jones movie and we watched Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. And the father character and Indy's relationship with his father, it is the whole crux of the movie. And it's about a son, an adult son trying to reconcile with a father that he's had a terrible relationship with throughout his life. And yes, there's the Holy Grail and, you know, there's all kinds of adventures, but ultimately that is what the movie is about. And if you look into Spielberg's biography, like you can see, like that's around the time when he was starting to do that exact same thing with his own dad. So there's all kinds of interesting stuff like that. So in terms of like my favorite Spielberg father, or at least the one that I often think of the most and have like kind of the warmest feelings about, the one that I picked was Frank Abagnale Sr., Christopher Walken's character from Catch Me If You Can, which is, I think, maybe the most, although it's changing now, it's one of the most underrated Spielberg movies.
Score, too.
Amazing John Williams score, amazing opening credits, amazing performances across the board. Fascinating movie, exciting. It is hilarious at times. It is one of Spielberg's funniest movies. It's also one of his most depressing movies. It is about pitiful loneliness and feeling like you don't fit in anywhere. It is about not having an identity. It is about trying to create an identity. And a big part of the movie is about the relationship between Frank Jr., Frank Sr., Leo, and Christopher Walken. And a lot of what Leonardo DiCaprio's character, who's supposedly based on a real person, although, I mean, I think to some extent,
they take liberties.
Well, it's not just that they take liberties. It seems like the real Frank Abagnale probably took some liberties with his own life and maybe made up he maybe made up a lot of the stuff that's presented as if it actually happened in this movie. I don't really think that matters, but in a way, it makes it better because the movie is about lying to live in some sense. So why not just make it all up anyway? But in the movie, you really see how the Leonardo DiCaprio character, Frank Jr., really, you know, so much of what he does is a reaction to what he sees, one, his father doing. His father is, you know, like kind of has these grand aspirations of being a big man in town and, you know, wants to be part of the Rotary Club. And he has all, you know, he really, in the beginning of the movie, he gives this speech where he's accepting an award, I think, from the Rotary Club. And he talks about, you know, in that typical Walken fashion, he talks about his, the two mice, they're in a big bowl of milk. And are they going to give up? The first mouse, he gives up, he drowns. But the other mouse, he struggles, he doesn't quit. He turns the milk to whipped cream. And ladies and gentlemen, I stand before you and I am that mouse. And I love, you know, and then again, that little speech is like reflected not only in his character, who we then see really struggling, even though he acts like he's a hotshot and he's made it to the top of the mountain in this early scene. You know, he's being investigated for tax fraud. Mm-hmm. He is a bit of a con artist himself. Everything is a hustle, just like with his son. I learned it from you, Dad.
I learned it by watching you.
Exactly. I mean, they don't literally say that, but it is kind of true. And there's sort of this beautiful, even though it's not a huge part, he kind of disappears from the movie after the first act and he does reappear intermittently. it is this beautiful and very sad story kind of about life's disappointments and struggle, struggling and not turning the milk into cream. But, you know, through it all, he also like really loves his son. It's a very affectionate portrait of this very flawed person who genuinely does love his son, wants the best for his son. And it is a stark difference to a lot of the other dads or absent dads throughout Spielberg's earlier career. And so I think that's a very interesting aspect of it as well, is not only is it a really great performance by Walken and a really interesting portrayal of a father and son, you know, like when you compare it to the totality of Spielberg's work, it gets more and more interesting. Especially, I find that everything Spielberg has ever made is more interesting after The Fabelmans. Every time you see something that he made before it or now after it with Disclosure Day, I'm thinking about Fabelmans while I'm watching Disclosure Day. Everything becomes more interesting. Every shot of a train, every every messed up family relationship, every piano in Disclosure Day. I don't think this is a spoiler. It's in the trailer. There's a huge set piece all involving getting smushed by a train. A train, you know, being the thing that Spielberg was obsessed with as a kid after he watched
From the Great Train,
greatest
Robert.
Show. The greatest show on
earth.
The greatest show on earth. Yeah. And inside the train, what is inside the train but a whole bunch of pianos, like his mom's piano? I mean, it's like he ain't subtle about it.
You know, that reminds me of when he was on Inside the Actor's Studio and James Lipton. And we'll get to your worst dad in a bit. I want Patrick to go first.
But
when he was on Inside the Actor's Studio with James Lipton, James Lipton pointed out that the climax of Close Encounters of the Third Kind is about a computer and a piano learning to talk to each other. And he said, did you realize, I mean, that's your parents, right? And Spielberg went, oh, I never noticed that, because his mom played piano and his dad was a programmer at IBM. And just the fact that he was even unaware of how he was using these movies as therapy, but that shows how personal they were to him, which always bleeds through in the screen. Pat, what about you? Give us your best before we cycle back to the worst.
My best, Ryan, this was a really big question to ask, because
it's tough.
You know, there are books written about this. What I've been thinking about is, obviously, Spielberg has been on this press tour for Disclosure Day. He's been doing a lot of podcasts, a lot of interviews. And I find that despite the guy having this astounding 50 plus year career of making great movies, he's constantly just asked about movies from like the same 15 year period that he's talked about so many times. And I feel like I've heard every story about Jaws and Raiders and E.T. and Jurassic Park. I'm like, guys, please ask him about something else, because I think the last 25 years of Spielberg's career has a lot of his very best work. It is often they're more complicated films. They're movies that are usually more targeted at adults, but I think they get overlooked way too often. And so I was like, look, I'm not saying this is the best sequence ever, but I just recently went to a 35mm screening of Minority Report, which is one of my absolute top tier Spielberg movies. And I was struck once again by how the opening sequence of that movie, I think, is one of the great opening sequences of all time, in that it's basically like a mini movie within the movie. It's a whole, like, you know, Minority Report, obviously, it's about the Department of Pre-Crime in Washington, D.C., about 50 years in the future. And so, you know, this sequence, there's so much that you have to be taught in this movie about the way the science fiction concepts work, the way the precogs work, the way these future cops work, just like the mechanics of how they do their job, because those mechanics are going to be so vital to the plot as it goes on. You have to introduce, John Anderton, your central character. And so you get like just this one, like him doing one job, like one mission, almost like a James Bond style cold open of here's one assignment kind of unrelated to what's going to be like the main one that'll drive the movie. And it's just this astonishing, like 10 minute, like basically short film that teaches you everything you need to know, basically without any dry exposition, just watching this guy on the job with a ticking clock and trying to stop this murder before it happens, cross-cutting between Cruz and his team in the pre-crime headquarters, and then this guy, Howard Marks. I've seen this movie so many times. Who is soon in a crime of passion going to murder his wife and the man she's having an affair with. And just watching these two, really these three, because we have like the images of like the future as well. These three narratives kind of like finally collide with this moment of like Cruz like sprinting up the stairs. Also some incredible Cruz running here. Basically while this guy is like swinging a pair of scissors that he's going to stab someone with. And it's just like, it is like absolute top tier Spielberg action filmmaking. It is such gorgeous, efficient storytelling and character work. And again, you learn so much about just like the people like Howard Marks and his family who never appear again. It's just this whole like, you know, intense domestic drama happening right there. And I'm just like that sequence right there, I think I would rank among the best set pieces he's ever done. And that movie has then like three or four more like astounding set pieces later on. But I think that I'm not saying it's the absolute number one best. I'm not saying it's better than the T-Rex breakout in Jurassic Park. It is just, I think, a top tier Spielberg sequence that does not get the discussion and respect it deserves. And so that's why I just wanted to use this platform to highlight it today.
You know, one thing about that scene too, you touched on it, is how much you're rooting for the cops to prevent the murder, you know, to prevent this woman from dying. Like you are, the opening's so great because it's action-packed. You're giving us point of view characters, like you said, but we are really on the side of the precogs, and they're setting us up to start the movie with that. And then of course, you know, after Cruz is framed and all this other stuff, it's there to kind of make us feel like predictive crime is not something that should happen. Matt, what do you think? And guys, my dog needs out real quick, so I'm going to leave you two alone, but I can still hear you and I'll be right back.
Oh, watch out. It's going to go off the rails now.
We're taking over. See ya. The one thing that I love, the first thing I always think of about Minority Report, and that is a great scene, is just that it came out the same year as Catch Me If You Can. The guy had, in one calendar year, he had Minority Report and Catch Me If You Can.
Like 6 months apart.
6 months apart, yeah. I think Minority was in the summer, and then Catch Me If You Can was like his Christmas movie that year.
Yeah.
Which he's done that before. Famously like Jurassic Park and Schindler's List are the same year. But man, that's just embarrassing to the rest of us.
I
mere
know.
Mortals, when it's like either one of those movies, to have one of them come out in a 5-year period, you'd be like, yeah, that was a pretty good stretch I had making this one movie. And he had both of them in 6 months. It's just.
Right. And this is not a thing like not to diminish anyone else's work, but like, yeah,
let's
like
diminish other people's work.
OK,
come on.
So like Richard Linklater thinks he's
F that
stuff
guy
coming out last year with two movies. And it's like, yeah, but one of those is all set in one bar.
That's
it's
right.
Like you can shoot that in like a week or two.
Yes.
It's like, you know, Minority Report and Catch Me If You Can, neither of those are simple movies.
Right.
Those are both like, one is like a big budget sci-fi action thriller. One is like I don't want to say globe-trotting, but it's a movie with a lot of locations.
It's an
like
America-trotting. He goes all over the country.
Yeah. And I'm like, how do you have the stamina to do both of those in a calendar year?
Yeah, it's wild. It's
and
it's
then really while wild. He was in airports, he must have gone ahead and filmed The Terminal, which is because I was thinking, I was like, wait a minute. So while they were doing VFX for Minority Report, it makes sense he would have a gap, kind of like how Robert Zemeckis did What Lies Beneath, you know, when they were like taking the
Castaway,
oh, okay, yeah. But no, then he did Terminal, and it's like, you're right. Just he kind of took a few years off. In the 90s, barely, but then after that,
well,
you guys
found
right.
DreamWorks.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
he tends to do that though. He tends to like kind of bunch movies up. He'll go years without doing things, and then he'll have like two things, like when he had Jurassic Park and Schindler's List. It's
right,
but nobody else does that, not regularly.
And we can't forget that. Minority Report and Catch Me If You Can, those are 2002. But he'd had AI the year before that. He had another big
gigantic,
budget, complicated like sci-fi movie exactly 12 months before Minority Report. And usually, you know, most directors, even if they're not making movies on that scale, are at least taking like 2 to 3 years between projects. And again, these movies are astounding. I think these are all masterpieces. So
I think AI is so underrated. People focus way too much on the ending, which I think is the best part of the movie. I've always thought, even when I was a 20-something who knew nothing about anything, I was like, yeah, they're robots. You can tell they're robots. They're not aliens. The whole point is that's what AI's evolved into. And I think that movie's genius, especially now when they're trying to invent AI. It's not. It's a large language model, but you're actually talking to these like horrifying programs, and you're seeing how they're always programmed to go, that's a great idea. You could type anything into an AI. I was thinking about blowing up my workplace. Oh, that's fantastic. Here's how you do it. And that's exactly how David is programmed in the movie. It's so prescient in so many ways. I love that film. It's not what I'm going to talk about, but there's that.
It's great. It's one of my favorites.
You know, and it's interesting because both the films, you know, Matt, to go back to Catch Me If You Can for a second, you know, Frank's dad, what's his dad's name again?
Frank Sr.
Frank Sr. Yeah. So there you go. They share a name, but they also share, he shows him how to present a lie and sell it. He has a fiction about himself. He tells stories about how he met his wife, which is this idealized version. There's the bucket of cream, but there's also the Yankees. People are looking at their pinstripes. Right.
Why do the Yankees always win?
Yeah. Which is ridiculous.
Because they're too busy looking at the pinstripes.
As Tom Hanks's character points out, though, it's ridiculous. They went because they have Mickey Mantle, you know, and right. So like, but
which is also the guess what Leonardo DiCaprio's character says in the movie too, when he asks him like, "Why do the Yankees always win?" He goes, "Because they have Mickey Mantle." He's like, "No, right. No."
But he invents that fiction along with his dad, and in a way, Minority Report is doing the same thing. It's creating this. It's investing in a fiction because until the moment somebody kills someone. It is a fiction. We don't know for sure that it was going to happen. That's what the movie's about. You can fake these things. And the fact that Minority Report also takes place in a future where everyone's face is scanned and the newspaper and the ads are tailored to your vision. It's a sci-fi story that's, you know, trope that's been around since the 50s. The fact that the world is actively selling a fiction. Is there anything about that era you guys think is why he was drawn to that particular idea at the time?
Ooh, well, it is one of those things where, you know, it's easy to be like, oh, the movie came out a year after 9/11 and there was the Patriot Act and stuff. It's like, yeah, but he shot it like before 9/11. Like we can't,
he probably thought about it 2 years before that.
Exactly. Right, yeah. Right. Like War of the Worlds is his post 9/11 movie.
What did Spielberg know and when did he know it?
Munich he made his fair share of post 9/11 movies, but it's the timing
world.
Makes you want to group Minority Report in there, but I agree. I don't. It's a little too early for that, I guess.
Right. It is just really good timing. On his part, it felt relevant in a way that he wasn't expecting it to. But in terms of trying to think back to the culture of like 2001 and two about
in 2000.
This is a really good question because it is the funny thing. I've been, you know, just like writing about Spielberg so much and it's funny where it's like, you know, he has said many a time in interviews that, he's like, oh, I've never been to therapy. Making movies is
not
therapy.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah. And it is,
we've been to his therapy. It's called the Fablemans.
We certainly have. And, but it is because he is a director of such power where he can kind of like, he can develop his own projects and basically get anything made that he wants to. Mm-hmm. Each one of these movies is a pretty good window into what he was thinking about at the time, because, you know, he usually has several projects in development and then there'll be a moment where he's like, this one is really clicking with me right now. I want to go in on this. This is just speaking to me. This is like capturing just like thoughts that are on my mind. And so, yeah. So you do have to wonder about like what, I mean, obviously Catch Me If You Can, it's, you know, it's like, oh, there's father son stuff. It's like, it's like, that's never gone away. But, and like Minority Report has less of it, but it is also about a father whose son was abducted and probably murdered. And so, I mean, there at this point, Spielberg has several kids. And so, you know, you have this his anxieties as a parent, which really started manifesting in like Hook is the first real instance of him just being an anxious new parent. And then that, you know, cropping up in basically every single movie from there on out. And so I don't know, maybe he just read some news stories about, you know, weird new surveillance stuff that and technology in the late 90s and was like,
no, I think you're right. I think parental anxiety is probably a lot to do with it. The same reason that, you know, Hook a few years ago is basically about him being afraid he was missing his kids' childhoods. All right, I'm going to do mine. So the categories I picked were just a moment in a Spielberg movie that just absolutely broke my brain and blew me away. And like, because sometimes you get this in art. You look at a painting, whatever, that just absolutely kind of makes you rethink the way you saw the world. And I almost didn't do this just because I was getting emotional when I talk about it. But in Schindler's List, when Oscar sees the girl in the red coat, I saw this, you know, when I was 14 years old. I had never seen, you know, the red balloon. I didn't know you could do this in a film. Pleasantville was still a few years away. And I remember, you know, you're watching this film and it's horrible and it's hitting you in all these ways. And then when I saw that, for some reason, I guess because I was very young, before that I was watching a movie. And in that moment, I was watching people, if that makes sense. Like that one moment where he makes that connection with her in a roundabout way made me make a connection with the movie and with the child and with him. And I saw, you know, I don't even know at that point I had learned about the Holocaust in school. So I'm sort of learning about it from this movie. It wasn't, you know, something that we, you know, I learned it in high school when I was only in junior high at the time. So that movie for me just kind of reopened my brain and showed me like what is possible in film as a visual medium to express an idea so purely. And of course, the red coat coming back later on is also incredibly haunting. Again, I thought about just keeping this as like talking about a blockbuster, but I just, nothing he's ever done has hit me like that single moment.
I mean, one of the things that's so amazing about that movie when I think back on it is that when you're watching it, you know, it has elements of it have these kind of documentary qualities to it, where he's telling this true story, but he's also documenting this much larger real world event, but that he also finds ways to add these, you know, gorgeous, haunting, devastating, poetic touches like the red coat, which is a moment where he takes you out of any sense that this is a documentary because he's breaking the kind of reality briefly, you know, that all of a sudden here is a splash of color in this black and white world that he's conjured when I saw it at that age that I, you know, it seemed so realistic and so then also find ways to inject these little moments like that where you have the confidence to, you know, kind of like break the illusion that you're casting to thread in this like devastatingly emotional little, almost like a subplot without it being really a plot. It's just this like running visual motif that carries this enormous impact. I mean, again, not a lot of directors could pull that off. And that's the thing I always think about in terms of that movie and also that specific element that you're citing is just that there's parts of that movie that, you know, they feel like somehow he's time traveled and captured something that really happened, but then he's so good that he can also bring this more poetic side to the film as well.
Yeah.
Okay, Pat.
Oh, I was going to say, yeah. Cause like in, obviously, you know, so much has been said about Schindler's List and how great it is, but you know, Spielberg had made a couple more serious, like quote unquote adult movies before that, like The Color Purple, Empire of the Sun. And there, you know, they're still, those are still, you know, very much shot and made like other Spielberg movies. It's you've got, you know, beautiful light coming, like pouring in through windows and stuff like that, you know, huge sweeping crane shots and everything, which is not a bad thing, but like he was kind of like doing his thing with those. And it is so striking in Schindler's List, the way he drops all of those, not just the black and white, but it is deliberately less painterly than his movies tended to be. It is very much like like handheld, looser, you know, almost like documentary style, cinematography that doesn't have the gloss that we're used to. And that's like the Red Coat's like the one time he like really like he uses a trick that does draw your attention. And but it is I don't want to even say he gets away with it. I think it fundamentally works so well because it's just like you're watching this whole thing basically through Liam Neeson's POV. And just that little touch to like emphasize him being drawn to this girl, it makes his experience of watching it stronger and puts you more in his shoes of just being a witness to this thing that you are powerless to stop. And scorching hot take, Schindler's List, good movie.
Well, there's also, one thing I thought about talking about, because I'm kind of obsessed with videos that go through blocking in film, like the Nerd Writer did a great one on Hitchcock a few years ago, and how many Spielberg shots people think are multiple shots, but there's no cuts, because you compared him to a painter, and that's absolutely right. He emulates the great masters and their use of triangles. Even in Jaws, there's this great shot where they go out on a ferry. We should have B-roll of it. Sorry. If you're listening to us on a podcast audio platform, then you don't need B-roll. But where they just go out on a ferry and just the blocking of the characters, and it isolates Brody on one side of the frame. And just the way, like in West Side Story, I almost talked about too, because that's the pinnacle, I think, of his skills of moving the camera. And you guys are right. He threw most of that away, or at least to the best of my memory, in Schindler's List and presented it as simply as possible, because I felt like he thought he had to present it honestly, except for that one moment, which again, maybe the film pulled me into that documentary style, and then that just hit me like a ton of bricks. But sorry, I had to mention it. Let's move on to the worst. Let's move on from Schindler's List to the worst that Spielberg has ever done. That's a deft transition. Matt, earlier you talked about your best, the best you think Spielberg dad. Who's the worst?
I mean, maybe the worst would be technically would be someone who like the dad in E.T. who's absent. That's maybe even worse, I suppose. Right. But I mean, when I always think of bad, all time bad movie dads, not just in Spielberg, but in general, in all of film, I always think about Richard Dreyfuss's character from Close Encounters. Oh, you picked a really flattering photograph of him as well.
I didn't pick it. And I mixed them up earlier, but yeah, it's a really good pull. Now, for those of us like myself,
he does spend 40% of the movie foaming at the mouth. We should mention that right off the bat. So it is a representative sample. But yeah,
catch us up on that character.
So yeah, I mean, Close Encounters was kind of that's a 1970. Is it 77 or 78?
I think 77.
77. Yeah. Okay. So it's the same year as Star Wars. That was his follow up to Jaws, and it is like it's really the movie he wanted to make before Jaws. He kind of got sidetracked. He's always had this fascination with UFOs and with aliens, as evidenced by the fact that 50 years later, his new movie is, I wouldn't say it's an actual sequel, but it certainly feels like a spiritual sequel or a kind of, almost like a, like bookmarking his career with his Close Encounters in the beginning. And even like, I guess he did make some of his student or, kid short films were about this as well, even though I think the main one is Lost. And now doing Disclosure Day, which, it's a very similar premise and a very similar concept of these ordinary people who have this experience, and they basically just, their whole life is thrown into chaos by the discovery of something otherworldly or supernatural. And, I don't want to necessarily spoil Disclosure Day for anybody. It might be about aliens. But in Close Encounters, it is a fascinating movie. It is a beautiful movie. It is one of his most like visually striking movies. And it has this incredible opening to rival Minority Report. It has an incredible ending sequence to rival anything he's made in any of his movies. But the Roy character, is an interesting one. And he's one that I really kind of, I struggle with. I mean, even when he's not foaming at the mouth, he's not a great dude. You know, as he's introduced, he's a dad. He's like a utility repairman in Indiana, I think. And he, you know, he's a father of three kids. He has a wife. And he seems reasonably happy in his life, but then he has this incident, this close encounter, you might say, of a certain kind on a deserted road, and it completely like snaps his brain, and he really, he has a, you know, almost like a midlife crisis with a specific reason. Essentially, he becomes fixated on this vision of this thing, which you eventually discover what it is, but this, you know, like this mountain that he keeps thinking about and seeing, and he keeps trying to recreate it. And it destroys his, spoiler alert, it destroys his life. It destroys his marriage, his family. He doesn't necessarily leave his family, but his family kind of like leaves him. His wife basically has enough of him, like, you know, freaking out and breaking windows and trying to turn their house into this mountain, that she packs up the kids and leaves. And I don't think I would necessarily like have an issue with that plot. And it is an interesting thing to think about in the totality of Spielberg's career and his life. And like, I think this was made at a time when his relationship with his dad was not particularly great. And I think you see that
it's early in his career. Yeah.
And I think you see that reflected in the story of this man who, you know, I guess you could say his family leaves him at first, but in a much larger way, by the end of the film, he's definitely left them because he, you know, again, spoiler alert, he kind of, he takes a trip away from the planet Earth, let's say. So,
and I think we're just real quick. I think we're assuming a lot of people know about Spielberg's life because they've seen The Fablemans. But in case you're listening and you haven't, Spielberg's family split up when he was a kid. They got divorced. His dad moved them around from city to city. And the movie, The Fablemans, at least, really makes it clear he was much closer to his mom, who was an artist, than his dad, who was this technical engineer. Like you said earlier, it's very much like his relationship with Henry Sr. and Henry Jr.
What he's talked about in his real life too is that at the time he really blamed his father for everything that happened to the family. Mm-hmm. Like his father was kind of the scapegoat, and his dad just kind of accepted the blame. And then what you see in The Fablemans is that it was a much more complicated story. And what he talks about now is that it was a much more complicated story and a relationship, and his mother was not so angelic after all. And again, that's why it's interesting to watch the role of fathers evolve in these things. And I guess just the thing that I just butt up against sometimes people talk about, oh, I had kids and my relationship to movies changed. I saw Interstellar when I was in my 20s, and then I saw it after I had kids, and it made me weep uncontrollably. I saw Close Encounters for the first time when I was probably a teenager, maybe, and then I saw it again when I was in my 20s. And rewatching it as a father, like I like it less. I don't know. But it's an interesting movie because it is kind of an angry movie in a certain way, or, you know, I don't know how much sympathy it has with Roy. Roy, kind of forgets that he even has a family. I guess that's kind of interesting as well. But, as dads go, I would say the things that this man does in this movie qualify him for bad and perhaps even worst dad status. And I feel like I could talk about him and this movie for hours because, you know, it's considered one of his ultimate masterpieces. And in some ways I absolutely agree. And I don't know, I feel like the Spielberg of later years would have written a more interesting arc for Roy. I feel like after his family leaves, the movie kind of loses me in a way, like the emotional tether. I find I lose a little bit because it's not just like, how is he going to stay with his family? Is he going to reconcile with them? It's not what it's about. And I guess maybe that's my problem, but that's something that I always get hung up on.
But the thing about Close Encounters is too, is that It really happened. It's not like, you know, he was obsessing over something fictional. There were aliens. He was visited. That he, you know, the mountain's real, that he was making out of mashed potatoes. So it's like, it kind of presents him like, yeah, bad dad. He drove the family away, whatever. But also he was justified because he pursued his dreams. And in a weird way there, you can kind of look years ahead to Hook and say, here's a dad who obsessed over his dreams and was afraid he was driving his children away. So there is definitely a theme there that carries on and matures through the years.
Yeah, and you could say that because there are aliens in the movie and he did have this actual encounter and he's not just losing his mind, that you could say that in some ways maybe that makes it sympathetic because it's, you know, he's presenting this guy who's, you know, had this profound experience. It's not just that he doesn't love his children or something. And so maybe that in some way makes it more sympathetic that it's not a man imagining these things and he's not chasing a woman, although he does kiss the other.
He knows there's a woman. No, that's in there. Yeah, there's that. I personally think the movie would have been improved if after all the magical stuff with the aliens happens, it just cuts to Roy in the desert by himself and we're seeing everything from his point of view. Like he's hallucinated this and he chased his family away for no reason. I'm kidding. I haven't seen the movie in 20 years. I barely remember it. Pat, what about you? You got a comment on that or do you want to talk about your worst?
Well, look, it's hard to argue that you know, Dreyfuss in Close Encounters is not a great dad. And it is funny. I was just for a video that I was editing literally yesterday, I was skimming through the 2017 Spielberg documentary that was made for HBO, and it's fun seeing just like various interviews, clips that he has in there talking about that movie, talking about his relationship with his dad and stuff like that, and how there was like a 15-year period where he like was really like estranged from his dad and was really mad at him because he didn't really know the details of what had happened. Mm-hmm. And he, in that documentary, he's even telling stories about like their experience together that he like straight up put into Close Encounters, like a part where like a time that like his dad like broke down crying at the dinner table. And then Spielberg as a teenager started like shouting at him and calling him a crybaby.
Crybaby scene. And,
wow.
In Close Encounters. And so it's the weird thing where like Dreyfuss in Close Encounters is like a combination of Spielberg's dad and Spielberg himself. Yeah. And so again, it's a big old therapy session. Because also that's one of the only movies that of his that he wrote himself. So clearly very personal. And again, the books that could be written just on dads in Spielberg movies.
True.
Yeah.
All right, Pat, what's your worst to go with your best opening?
It's also about a dad.
It's hard not to.
they come up a lot. So full disclosure,
full disclosure day.
I haven't seen the movie yet. I'm seeing it tomorrow. But I've spent the last like 3 weeks working on like an hour long video about the film Hook that will be dropping on Nebula either today or tomorrow.
Sweet.
It's exporting now. And so I've been thinking about Hook a lot, a movie that, despite, you know, it's kind of a millennial classic. And as a millennial, I'm like supposed to love it because I did grow up with it. And it's always kind of driven me insane. And so I decided to finally make a video about it and just study it for like a month of my life and get to the bottom of like, what's up with this movie? And what was going on with Spielberg that like led him to make it? And what was he trying to like work out through making this? Because I don't think Hook works, but I do think it's really, really interesting as like this, again, this window into this guy at the time, because Hook came at this time when he was like really trying to like transition into more adult movies, basically get to make Schindler's List. You know, he had just done Empire of the Sun, a movie of you know, like about this child, like basically being forced to become an adult. And so it is so strange to me that I get the like the fatherly anxieties, but it's so strange to me that he would at this point in his life make a movie about like, actually, you've got to reconnect with your inner child and just regress into childhood. And that's the solution. And so look, I there's a lot of parts of Hook that drive me nuts, but the very ending of the movie where Peter Banning, played by Robin Williams, returns to London and basically is just in full kid mode and manically climbs up a drain pipe and throws his cell phone out the window and looks out the window and is like, to live would be a very great adventure. I'm just like, I look at this, I'm like, I don't, especially having gone through and like studied this movie so much. And also there's the weird thing in the film. This is like the least of its problems where this is Toodles, one of the original Lost Boys who clearly came back with Wendy from Neverland like 60 years earlier, who early in the film is like, I lost my marbles. Do you know where my marbles are? And you think he's a senile old man. And then the film does reveal that actually in Neverland, I believe it's Thudbutt, who becomes
please,
the future
please,
leader.
Mr. Thudbutt, please.
Mr. Thudbutt, yeah.
Mr. Thudbutt.
Dr. Thudbutt. He didn't go to Thudbutt Medical School to be called Mr.
And also, lest we forget, in the big feast scene before they break out in a food fight, there's a giant block of cheese that has Thudbutt's face carved into it and the words Thudbutt. Weird movie. But Thudbutt gives him Toodles' marbles, and he's like, oh, there were actual physical marbles. But then I'm like, wait, so Toodles left these marbles behind 60 years ago and only now is like freaking out because he lost them? Maybe he is senile? I don't know. Again, weird movie, but that's how it ends. But
oh yeah, that's a good point.
The movie has bigger problems, but it is this thing where I feel like over the course of Hook, Spielberg has realized that actually he's kind of like very over making these kinds of like children's movies. Like most of that movie, it feels more like the Goonies than like most other Spielberg movies. And like in Hook, I can sense Spielberg getting bored with a lot of this and realizing he doesn't want to do stuff like this anymore. He wants to make movies like Schindler's List. And so that ending where like the solution to it all is to basically just become a child again. And there he is as this old man flies around Big Ben and he looks out with optimism at his new childish life. To me, it feels so insincere. And like, I can imagine Spielberg making this movie, finishing it and being like, I don't believe this at all. And because obviously he's spoken many a time about how he is not fond of Hook, how he does not like the movie that he made there. And so again, I'm not saying it is the worst scene of his career, but just having been thinking about this movie so much, that to me, that ending feel like if I was watching this in 1991 when it came out and I was a Spielberg fan, I would be like, this is a low point. This guy has he lost the plot a little bit? If
he's
this
lost
is
his marbles.
There you go. And then 2 years later, we would learn, oh no, he's doing better than ever. He's totally fine. He got that out of his system. But yeah, end of Hook.
I did see Hook in the theater in 1991, and I did not like it very much. And I remember that feeling of like, no, oh, this is, you know. And then when you go
were you expecting it, Matt? Were you expecting it to be good because you understood Steven Spielberg and the movies he'd done
before?
Well,
I mean,
I was
10 years old, but I mean, I had seen every Indiana Jones movie and I had, you know, and I had seen, I probably had seen Jaws by that point, but just knowing him from Raiders and Indiana Jones, everything Indiana Jones and watching those movies over and over, like, yes, I was expecting. And also he was the guy, you know, like he was famous, you know, he produced Gremlins, he produced Goonies, he was the guy who made all these things that I liked. But I agree, it's like, I can't get on board the Hook is good actually train, but it is an interesting, like very weird, interesting movie. And just listening to you talk about like, that he was getting like sick of making this kind of movie, I think is an interesting way to look at it. And it makes me think, like, in a way, the movie is kind of trapped. Literally, in terms of the subject, it is trapped. It's like a character who's trapped between adulthood and childhood and kind of bouncing back and forth and trying to be an adult while maintaining his youthful outlook or his youthful spirit. And, you know, you can almost read the movie as like Spielberg trying to still make movies that are, you know, full of childish whimsy and are good for kids, but also to address more serious themes and to talk to more, you know, important topics that were on his mind. And then the movie comes out. And then, like we already talked about, in 1993, he has Jurassic Park and Schindler's List. And it's almost like he said, trying to do both of these things in one thing is a bad idea. But if I separate them, if I put all the fun, childish things in Jurassic Park and I put the more serious things in Schindler's List, maybe that will work. And spoiler alert, it really worked really, really well to do it that way. And so I wonder how much of those movies are kind of a reaction to not just being dissatisfied with the outcome, but maybe just the process of making Hook and trying to make something that was like, you know, the ultimate four quadrant thing where it's for everybody. And it also contains these weighty themes, but also it has like, yeah. What's the guy's name? Mr. Dr. Yeah. And he's and like, there's cheese with his name on it. Like,
yeah,
it's tough
and,
to
and
make
he turns into a bowling ball and rolls down a ramp. And rolls. And
that's right. He
over.
Rolls. Yeah, exactly. It's very tough. That's even for Spielberg. That's a tough needle to thread. So
yeah.
I don't know.
And I feel like it must be said, and Jurassic Park is also, while aimed at a younger audience than Schindler's List, it's also a scary movie starring mostly middle-aged people. And there are kids, but they're supporting characters. It's not all about the kids.
Right.
And we meet Alan Grant when he frightens a child for his own amusement and threatens to disembowel him with a raptor claw.
And he hates kids. Yeah, he has to regain his own childlike wonder about dinosaurs and
right his that. Big arc is being like, okay, I don't hate kids.
I don't want to see children maybe. Viciously murdered by dinosaurs, I guess.
Yeah,
but I don't ever want to have them. Only have, before I get to my worst, the character Alan Grant, because obviously like Ellie has kids and so the whole thing. Anyways, before we get to my worst, we only have one super chat today. It's from Armand, and I don't remember what the end of your name is. Armand yesterday gave us five pounds again today and announced that he was very drunk. But that is because it is 5 hours ahead in the UK, where presumably you're spending your pounds. If not, hey, you know what? It's Disclosure Day coming up soon. We're all in a good mood. He said, I watched Disclosure Day in 2 hours on IMAX. Also, somehow I'm not hungover from yesterday. So we appreciate the update. Really just let us know all through your pub crawl. If you give us $5 each time, we always appreciate it. And thanks to everybody else who normally gives super chats. But if you don't today, that's absolutely fine. They're encouraged, but not required. So here's my worst. Earlier, I talked about how Schindler's List kind of broke my brain and, you know, showed me what was possible in cinema. And I made a connection with film maybe I hadn't made on an emotional level before. But a different kind of brain breaking is when something you think of as canon to, like, look, with me, say, Star Wars and Marvel Comics, I know that they're just fictional stories, but I also always had the feeling that these are a canon, you know, like a thing that is being written down and recorded. So when I would watch, when I would read like the next Spider-Man issue, I would always think like, oh yeah, this is what's happening to Spider-Man. You know, like it was sort of official in some way. And I had my break with comics in the late 90s with things like the Clone Saga. But when Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull came out, right, I'd been following the development of this movie on Ain't It Cool and other sites for years and in my Shyamalan screenplays. I was so excited about it. And early in the movie, when they're talking to Indy and we hear like, oh, this guy was a hero. He was in the OSS during the war. I thought, oh, so that's what Indiana Jones was doing during the war. You know, like that for me, it was like getting to know what the character did. Even though I know he's fictional, it's sort of like I just always had this mindset of, yeah, but he's kind of real. Like, he's real to me. And, you know, like the first time I saw somebody operating Kermit, it broke my brain a little bit because you always think of Kermit as this real guy. So in this movie, I liked the fridge scene. Still think it's appropriate to the film. Everybody else hates it, but you look at all the other bullshit Indiana Jones survives in these movies. It's not too far off from it. And then we got to this. We got to the monkey swinging scene. And earlier we had this kick-ass action scene with Mud and the campus and the chase and the motorcycle. And then we got to this and it was so bad and it felt so out of place and so much like Spielberg was not in command of anything. It made me only play the end frame there. It made me go, oh, this is a fucking movie. Like, I'm watching a movie. I'm not watching recorded historical canon about the true adventures of Indiana Jones as imagined by George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. This is just a movie that's disappointing me all over the place. And that's where I kind of saw like the invincibility I thought films had before, at least that world, was kind of shattered for me. So it broke my brain a little bit.
I can't defend you guys, I can't defend that scene. I'm sorry.
Nor can I.
I mean, I actually down. Like the nuke the fridge moment. I have no problem with that whatsoever. To me, that's a fun opening sequence. To me, all the heat went on that scene when the one that you just showed is so much worse, so much harder to defend. And I mean, I get the idea that, look, all Indiana Jones movies are pastiches. They're always pulling from places. And here we're like, it's in a way we've got like Marlon Brando, biker Marlon Brando swinging on vines like Tarzan. And in a weird way, I can kind of get behind the kookiness of that, but it just looks so bad and it just looks so artificial. And I think of Spielberg as this, you know, master of special effects, but and digital effects too. And I just can't think of too many other examples where he like lost command of the imagery to a way where it just looked so plastic and fake and silly. Stop making me relive it.
You're listening to us on podcast platforms. I keep showing
it gives off big, like George Lucas prequel vibes where it's just like, absolutely, nothing you're looking at is real. It's all, you know, it's like Shia LaBeouf is in a harness on a blue screen and we filled in everything else and nothing has any kind of weight or reality to it. And that to me is it's a pretty unforgivable part of that movie, which I overall don't hate that movie. There are parts of it that I really like. And, you know, the beginning of that movie has this fairly practical and, pretty grounded motorcycle chase, which is really awesome. Good. Yeah.
Very
it's
good.
Really, really good. And then by the end of the movie, yeah, there's like fire ant swarms that are eating people and there's the monkeys.
And you're right. It was an attempt at a cross genre thing. And they're doing those like adventure serials and comics and Scrooge McDuck, which was like George Lucas's big comic he loved when he was a kid alongside Flash Gordon. But man, it just, cause everything else in these movies felt real, you know, like it was a stunt work done by real actors. And you get to that and you're like, nothing about this seems, it just completely took me out of it. It took me out of it more than the presence of aliens and the spaceship at the end and the explosion at the beginning. It just really ripped me out of the movie.
Yeah, the thing about Crystal Skull, which again, it's not also not a movie that I hate, just not one that I especially like. It's got its moments, but I remember the development process for a fourth Indiana Jones seemed to last for years and years and years. They were always trying to make one. And if I remember correctly, what happened was, I think there was the point where they had like the Frank Darabont script that I think
the
like Spielberg,
from
like
Mars.
I think it was the City of the Gods.
City of the Gods was the
Frank. Is that what Darabont it was? Okay.
Yeah. Yes. And like Spielberg liked it and Ford liked it. And George was like, no. This is not the one. And then, another like 8 years goes on or whatever. And I remember this one interview in like an EPK that came out, like when the movie was finally released, where Spielberg was talking about the development process. He was like, and I kept saying like, no, I don't want to do it. No, it's fine. And George finally wore me down. And I said, yeah, okay, George, I'll do it. And that to me has always like been like the vibe of this movie to me.
Smash cut to that video that you just played four times of Shia LaBeouf swinging on
bar. Yeah, exactly.
Right. It's like, exactly. Why does that feel? And like, you know, I don't know what happened. I was not on set for this. And also I don't, you know, like I George Lucas gets too much shit. I love the
Agreed.
Guy, but a sequence like that feels so much more representative of like 2000s George Lucas than any era Steven Spielberg. And it's like, why are they not on a location? The whole point of the Indiana Jones movies is to go to locations. They've gone to plenty of jungles before. Why are they like in a studio on a green screen? And I'm just like, I don't know. My headcanon here is that at certain points, Steve was just like, yeah, sure, George, we'll do it however you want it. I just want to make you
happy. It's very Sky Captain. It's very Sky Captain in the World of Tomorrow, but that movie at least said, no, it's like the 1930s. Like, we're taking a 1930s pulp magazine cover, bringing it to life, and it created a world in that context. It looked fake on purpose, you could say.
The Darabont script is online. It is awesome. It is way better than Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, at least on paper. You know, anything could happen when they made it. But it, as a script, it is so much better. If you don't want to read the whole thing, I actually, a couple years ago, I think when Dial of Destiny came out, I wrote a piece on Screen Crush. You can find
great piece
where I just kind of broke down like the what happens in the script and the differences between the two and why it's better. I mean, it's just, yes, it is. It's kind of a tragedy that that version was the one that didn't get made, because it is really, it just seems a lot better. And that scene couldn't have been in it because there's no Mutt Williams in that script. He's not even in that script.
Well, now there's no Mutt Williams at all because he died between movies.
Spoiler alert.
Off screen in Vietnam, which I got to think they did that to leave the door open for a possible Mutt Williams return.
I don't know.
Mutt Williams cinematic universe.
I'm not a Dial of Destiny fan. And it's so wild to me that at the end of that movie, Indy is in the exact same place he was at the end of Crystal Skull. The only difference is now Mutt is dead. It does feel like they made the entire movie just to be like, don't worry, we hate Mutt Williams too, and we're going to kill him off screen.
Well, I got to leave it there, guys. That's us for an hour. Thanks so much. Thanks for all the chats. It's been fun following along with you guys. And of course, Patrick, you can find Patrick on his own YouTube channel. That is linked below. Matt, you can find him always on Blue Sky. I think you're on mostly, but here on Screen Crush. And don't forget, Matt's got Opposable Thumbs, The Story of Siskel and Ebert. And your new book comes out in October. What's the name of that one?
It's on the shelf behind me there. Funny Business. Funny Business. It comes out October 6th. A book all about
it's about
Hollywood
like comedies. The Ben Stiller era Hollywood comedies of the 2000s. I'm so excited to read it. All right, Pat, Matt, thanks. See you guys later. And we'll talk to you guys down in the comments below, where you can find us on our free to join Discord server. And if it's your first time here, be sure to subscribe, smash that bell for alerts, and let us know in the comments, what do you think is the best and worst of Spielberg, and what did you think of Disclosure Day? For screen